I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Today, our guest is Rich Baney. Rich is the president and CEO of E.W. Scripps Company. And you've been at E.W. Scripps for quite a while. The industry has certainly changed in that time. Television in particular has changed a lot, where it was a few stations to many. How much innovation do you have to do to sort of keep ahead of the curve at Scripps?
If you think about media, it's actually a very new business. Television is 50, 60 years old. That's really pretty new. So you're in that phase now where, you know, you both have a lot of fragmentation of television across cable, and now you're seeing us move and innovate onto the digital platform. So here in Cincinnati, WCPO, the products that we'll offer you on an iPad, in some cases will look like what we show you on TV, and in some cases they'll be entirely different products, different shows. I tell our board all the time that, you know, you can do great planning and have great strategies, but creativity is what provides the premium in our business. Scripps is still that kind of place where the creatives are the most honored in our organization, and we have to have them, have to have great creative talent if you're going to continue to innovate and succeed over time.
You just recently bought some TV stations, and interestingly, five of those are Spanish-speaking stations. Is that a movement that you think you're going to be getting more and more into, just diversity in terms of different languages in your stations?
Yeah, the Spanish media market continues to grow, and we've spent a lot of time over the years looking and trying to figure out how to find a good entry point. And this was just a good opportunity. We picked up these stations. They're in very good Spanish language markets at a great price. So we're now putting a group together and see if there's a good and big opportunity for us in Spanish language TV. So it'll take a little while, but it was part of the deal that we were really excited about.
What's going on with online newspapers? Has anybody figured out how to really make money out of that yet? Or is it still sort of at the early stages of that from an economic standpoint?
Well, you're seeing dramatic movement there over the past 12 months. The next 24 months, I think, will be even more dramatic, where many newspapers have just decided we cannot give this content away for free. This is not a sustainable model. So you're seeing memberships and paywalls come up. We're doing that fairly aggressively in some of our markets.
And what's a paywall?
A paywall is a subscription for an internet newspaper. I'm not sure how we decided, and I have to take part of the blame, I guess, that we thought it made sense to have your newspaper in print and pay and charge for that. And then we thought, for some reason, we'll just give it away on the internet, as we've come to learn, is just not a sustainable model. So we're going to start charging subscriptions online, just like we do in print. Or you can bundle across and be a print and a digital subscriber. I'm not sure what the folks here in town will do. We don't own the Enquirer. But in many of our markets, we're going to start trying to charge and offer great content that people want to pay for.
Where do you see in 5 years? I mean, where do you see the media world?
The digital platforms will be much more mature in 5 years. TV and the internet will merge quite a bit over the next 5 years, and you'll see what's called connected TV. People are probably seeing them in stores this holiday season, where you can bring in things from YouTube and all kinds of internet services right in a menu beside the channels you pick up either over the air or on cable. So that merger of the digital world and broadcast television is definitely going to mature over the next few years.
Rich Baney, President and CEO of the E.W. Scripps Company, thanks so much for being our guest. And thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Rich Baney. Rich is the president and the CEO of E.W. Scripps. You have been CEO at Scripps now for how long?
About 4 years.
But you've been with the organization for many years
prior
to that. A long
time. I was chief operating officer prior to that.
And you just came off of your really good results. Your quarterly results were well. However, your margins aren't nearly as good as other TV stations. Maybe you can explain the theory behind that.
Yeah, that's really just a long-term investment move. We believe in taking money off the bottom line to invest in building businesses and believe that shows the best return on investment. We have cash. We're going to borrow a little money to buy these TV stations that we just picked up. But for the most part, we have one of the finest and cleanest and most attractive balance sheets in our industry.
Is that partly your legacy from the Scripps family, where it seems like you're very long-term oriented, whereas a lot of public companies tend to be a little more quarter-to-quarter?
Yeah, we're very long-term. It's a 130-year-old company. I guess, at least from my point of view, we never bet the farm. We focus on long-term and constant innovation and evolution. Just don't believe in trying to make big pivots in the company and head in some different direction.
You look to the long-term. You're not so immediate results-oriented.
No, we have a very return on investment culture versus a quarterly earnings kind of culture.
Which makes a lot of sense.
I think that makes sense over the long-term.
What do you think about our region, Rich, in terms of what we need to do to really move and advance?
You know, probably most important, we have incredible assets. I mean, this is a huge corporation town. Probably what we don't understand as well is it's a very competitive environment. You've got to fight for every job, every company. We probably have to get better at getting in there and taking share from other competing markets. So you're just not going to have natural growth anymore. You're going to have to get out there and get it.
Is that a leadership, elected leadership issue, do you think? Or is that our business community not pulling together and really getting that done?
Well, I think the business community pulls together fairly well. And it's a good business community. And it cares about the whole community, not just about the companies themselves. Elected leadership certainly plays a role, and we have a very fragmented government structure in this region. You know, they're going to have to figure out how to pull the public sector together a little better over time so we can all work and row in the same direction.
The presidential election's coming up a year from now, and that usually means big things for people that own TV stations, doesn't it?
Yeah, we're in a lot of ways in every other year business. So, yeah, 2012 is shaping up to be an incredible year from a political standpoint. We gear up both on the sales side because we handle a lot of political advertising in all of our markets, and we're in great markets for political. But then on top of that, we try to make sure we are the platform in our markets for all political debate and discussion. We'll take any debate on our air we can get and just believe that that's our important role in the community to play. So we have sort of a Super Bowl every other year, and 12 is going to be like the Super Bowl.
Now, I don't know if from a viewer's standpoint if that's all that great of news though, Rich.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it gets a little tough in the fall.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, those credit card statements are rolling in the mail, and many people are finding that they are overextended, too much holiday debt causing them to have a problem in how they're going to pay it off.
Well, I hope that's not the case at our house.
It's not.
Well, that's good. But seriously, a lot of people are faced with that issue. You know, there's reasons why you should try to avoid being in that situation, but once you're in it, you just have to organize your debts, see what your payments are, plan to make sure that you can at least make the minimum payments on those credit cards so that you don't get stuck with late fees.
Absolutely important to pay the minimum, but that's going to take you a long time to pay off those credit cards. So you need to get into some type of a plan where you can pay more than the minimum balance so that you can eliminate the debt as soon as possible.
And you have to analyze your credit card debt or any installment debt that you have and see what the interest rates are and pay the highest interest rate debt off first. There may be a higher interest rate than you thought on some of your credit cards, because sometimes if you have a worse credit score or you make a late payment, the credit card company can hike the interest rate.
And if you do find that you're in a jam and you can't pay your minimum balances, call the credit card company. See if they can do anything like reduce the amount of payment, lower the interest rate, anything that can help you adhere to the minimum payment schedule so you don't harm your credit score. Often, credit card companies will negotiate and they will work with you.
Well, and you should see if you can consolidate your debt, maybe get less expensive debt and pay off some of those credit card debts. But if you're doing that, don't then go back out and run up the debt again.
And one way to do that, to at least pay off the credit cards, is if you have equity in your home. And as much as I don't like to talk about this, it can be a good solution to pull some of the equity out of your home, pay off the credit cards, because typically home mortgage or credit lines are lower than credit card debt in terms of interest rates. The downside to that, obviously, is you don't want to go out and run those credit cards back up. You've put your home in jeopardy then.
Yes, and if you're going to use the home equity line, take the savings that you've gotten in interest and use that to make greater principal payments so that you're still paying your debt down.
There are debt consolidation agencies out there. You have to be careful about those. They are expensive. They have some unintended consequences. So do your homework. There are also nonprofit organizations that will help you for free, generally, at least for some of the first few consultations, help you get your financial life in order. For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Tom, it's almost the middle of January, and many people are getting tax information statements in the mail. And often the questions become, what do we do? How do I know if these are right?
The first thing you should do is set up a system so that you can organize all the information that you get, because you're going to get it periodically over the next month or 6 weeks. You're going to get 1099s for income, for interest, for dividends, statements from your mortgage provider for your mortgage interest amount, W-2 forms. You need to find a place where you can keep all that so you can find it when you need it and organize it. And then when it comes in, try to check to see if it's the correct amount.
Because often these organizations make mistakes. And certainly if you do get a 1099 from a brokerage house or your financial institution, you should check it with your own records just to be sure that the information that they're telling the IRS matches what you show in your own records.
The other thing you should do is determine which information you should be getting. You know, look at last year's tax return, see what forms you received last year, you know, and make sure that you get those forms from the same people. For instance, you don't want to be looking for a 1099 form in April when you're getting ready to file your tax return. Look for it in January, and if you didn't receive it in the mail, call the provider and have them send you another copy. Sometimes these things do get lost in the mail.
It's a good idea to keep the final statements, for example, of your December statements that shows the year-to-date information of your various accounts, too, and start looking at your credit card statements. Some credit cards will actually provide an annual summary of expenses. So go through those, see if there are any deductible items, such as contributions or any business expenses that you may have incurred, medical costs that you can start keeping track of so you can make sure you take those as deductions when you file your tax return.
Yeah, and it's also a good time to go through your checkbook or however you keep your check records or your electronic bill pay records, however you pay your bills, and look for the tax deductions, the things like real estate taxes that you may have paid or charitable contributions that you may have made.
You know, I know it's a hassle. People don't like to deal with this kind of information, but these things make a big difference. If you are missing deductions, if you are not taking advantage of all of the expenses that you are able to deduct on your tax return, I think you're leaving money on the table.
Well, you're just making a contribution to the federal government.
And of course, we all want to do that these days, don't we?
That's right. We know they'll use the money wisely.
Tom and I are going to be hosting a tax chat on Cincinnati.com on February 4th. So if you do have any questions, you can certainly join us on that tax chat from 9 till 11. Or if you have questions, you can certainly call the station or email us here at WNKU, and we'll be happy to help you answer your year-end tax questions as well.
And many people have questions because they've had some change in circumstances during 2011 that will affect that tax return. You know, maybe their change in filing status, maybe they're not sure whether or not they can take their son or daughter as a dependent because they may be in college or work part-time. And those are usually pretty easy questions to answer once we have the facts.
Also, some people have unfortunately had some issues with regard to debt and credit problems, and we can help you answer anything like that, or invested in some real estate because of the values are so low, and that gives you a whole different dimension to your tax return. So feel free to email us. Again, you can email me at cfaulkner@cfscpa.com, or you can email the station and they'll get us the information. For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Andy McCraner. Andy is the executive director and the CEO of Executive Service Corp of Cincinnati, which is a nonprofit organization that helps not-for-profit companies become better stewards of money. You help them with business concepts. You just help them to be more successful. And many of us in this economy have just learned to do more with less. That clearly is a concept that businesses have had to embrace. Are you seeing the same thing in nonprofits?
Absolutely. The challenge with nonprofits, we all know budgets have been cut, economic times have created severe stress on a lot of organizations. That's not just exclusive to the not-for-profits, but with the revenue that they normally were getting, whether that's through government payments or however their nonprofit functions, the bottom line is there is just simply less of that going around as far as their ability to deliver on their mission. As a consequence of that, they have cut staff. They have also had to deal with cutting services to the public as far as people who really do have genuine needs for a variety of different reasons. So our organization, Executive Service Corps, we try to help them think through more strategically how they are delivering those services to the marketplace, how to sustain themselves in the long run.
if a not-for-profit doesn't learn how to operate efficiently, they may not survive. What is the survival rate for not-for-profits?
According to a Times Magazine research article, and I want to believe this was back in 2007, only one-third of nonprofits actually make it past 5 years. So failure rate is high, even though there's a lot of new nonprofits that start up year in and year out. The survival rate's not real good.
And it's very similar to the statistics for startup young business, and I think a lot of it is because of the passion that even an entrepreneur has about his particular business. He may not have the business and management skills that are necessary to be successful in the long term.
Yeah, absolutely correct.
One thing that I hear a lot, and you know, our firm started a not-for-profit several years ago called Accounting for Kids, and every year we have an event, and every year we're very particular in about how we use the funds. We try to keep the administrative costs very low. We keep the overhead low. But I hear a lot of people concerned about the contribution that they make. Is it really going for the nonprofit purpose? Do you find that sometimes certain nonprofits either intentionally or unintentionally spend money on administrative costs more than they should?
I certainly would say they're unintentional for the most part. It happens. And that's, again, not because anybody's willfully trying to do anything wrong necessarily. I think it comes down to knowledge and experience and their ability to really operate more effectively that way. So we do see cases like that, certainly.
What's the fix for that? I mean, how do you try to help not-for-profits that have too much overhead or too much administrative cost?
Primarily, we focus on the delivery of the mission to the marketplace. In other words, all of these nonprofits have missions that specifically say, we want to be able to do this for people. So our focus at Executive Service Corps is really to try to help them understand, what does that take? Is there a value proposition there for what they are delivering to the marketplace? And if it is, then how much more effectively can they do that?
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Andy McCraner. He is the Executive Director and CEO of Executive Service Corps of Cincinnati. Executive Service Corps is kind of like SCORE, which a lot of people know of, except you deal with not-for-profits. And you recently started a concept, well, recently, I guess it's been about a year now, called the Greenhouse, which has to do with shared services for not-for-profits. And we hear a lot about shared services from a government standpoint, but maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this works in the nonprofit world.
Just to give you a little bit of background on how the Greenhouse even got started, we worked with CMC Properties, which owns several office parks in the greater Cincinnati region and apartment complexes. But we have been tenants of theirs for about the last 10 or 12 years. And about a year ago, a little over a year ago, we approached Jim Cohen, the president of that organization, about more space for Executive Service Corps. And as we were talking through that, it gave way to more of, gee, what if we could come up with a concept where shared services could include training room access, conference rooms, meeting rooms, eventually become more than that. So we basically formed a partnership, and we became the anchor tenant for the Greenhouse. So that's really how it started. It started with the idea that we were going to focus on affordable space, common area training room, common area meeting rooms. So that was the beginning point of it.
There's several of you as a part of the Executive Service Corps here locally, correct?
Yes, we have 130 active volunteer consultants who volunteer their time and talent. They have lots of business experience and knowledge. And this is our way of giving back to the community, and we focus on nonprofits to help do that.
Do you typically work with new or newer not-for-profits versus more established ones?
We will do the newer ones, but most of our work is really with established nonprofits who are ready for their next stage of growth and or encountering difficulties, issues because of how the marketplace has been, the dynamics there. So we'll help them with strategic thinking, board development, organizational assessment, that type of thing. And ultimately, what we're trying to help them do is their passion for the mission. We try to balance that with what's needed to run the business.
And then the marketing and the overall messaging that goes out into the community, I would have to imagine that's something that nonprofits would really appreciate, especially when there's so many different organizations competing for such scarce resources.
And we're hoping that the Greenhouse actually creates a focal point for nonprofits that participate with the Greenhouse. That adds some image, that adds some credibility to that nonprofit in the sense of what they are able to demonstrate to the market.
Do they have to be an occupant to be able to benefit from your services?
We would certainly like them to be an occupant of the greenhouse, but we do have some situations where they are interested in having access to the training room or the conference rooms, things like that. So they don't actually have to be a tenant in order to be able to take advantage of the services.
Is the greenhouse really green, or where'd you come up with that name?
Well, I give CMC credit for the coming up with the name. The idea was is that we wanted to understand that we had a concept where nonprofits could come and organize themselves a little more with the idea that eventually it could grow. So it kind of came out of that.
Grow, green. Mm-hmm. I got it.
And I think the key really there is that we wanted to convey this nurturing environment, and that's what the greenhouse kind of does.
So if there is someone listening who is either a nonprofit who would like more information about how to join the greenhouse, or an individual who would like to contribute and volunteer some time, how can they reach you?
Executive Service Corps, we are at 791-6230.
That's 513.
513, yes. And that would be extension 10. Or you could go to www.esc-cincinnati, all spelled out, .org. And then you could also go to www.greenhousegrow.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Michael Debler. Michael is the Bankruptcy and Creditors Rights Group Leader at Graydon Head, which is a law firm in Cincinnati. And we hear a lot of cocktail talk where people who may know now that they aren't going to be able to keep their house. They just don't have the cash flow and the funds to be able to support the mortgage. And they just stop paying on their mortgage and they collect and accumulate a little fund of cash. There seems to be some confusion, I think, that people think they can keep that money when the bank comes in and forecloses, and that's not correct, is it?
People read in USA Today an article where people have just subscribed to a website called justwalkaway.com. That may work in California. It may work in Colorado. In the tri-state, in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, where we have judicial foreclosures, it's not true. So if you stop paying, there will come a day where there will be a financial reckoning, and you have to deal with the fact that you owe the bank the money that you didn't pay them.
Really, that may take a couple years. Is that true for the actual foreclosure to take place in Ohio, for instance?
Yes, that is correct. In Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, they all have the same type of court process, where the process from start to end can take 6, 8 months, a year. Other states have a much more compact process, and that's where they get into walking away because the lenders avail themselves of a short process. Here, we have a lengthy process. It takes time from beginning to end. So when someone says, I'm in foreclosure, it doesn't mean there's a sheriff's sale next week. It could be 8 months, a year down the road.
What's happening to people who are in loans that they probably can't afford and should have never gotten into the first place, but the interest rate is so high, they don't qualify. Their assets aren't such that they can actually refinance to today's lower rates. Isn't there something new that's recently occurred that may help them?
Yes, there is. And the problem has been where people were underwater, they couldn't get an appraisal that would show they had value in their property to refinance. Now there's a new program where if people are current on their mortgage loan, they can go out and have it refinanced, not take any new money out, but effectively just lower their interest rate. So that's a great benefit to them. It's a new program. It's another reason why people ought to think twice before they default on their mortgage loan, because there are programs now which allow them to lessen their payments by refinancing to a lower interest rate.
The unemployment rate seems to be ticking down a little bit. Is the foreclosure crisis starting to end too?
We thought that it was for a while just because there had been a problem with the robo-signing. A lot of procedural issues where the foreclosure crisis stopped for a while. Now it's going to gear back up. And most people see for the coming year that it will increase back up again. There will be more foreclosures out there. Whatever lull we saw, it will get busy again.
What about bankruptcies? Is that the same trend line?
From the consumer side, the bankruptcies are down. In 2005, there was a major modification to the bankruptcy law. There was a lot of bankruptcies filed then. During the first part of the recession, there were more. These days, there's less being filed.
If someone thinks that they're going to have a problem down the road or they currently have a problem, is there any specific steps, any actions that they should be taking now?
Absolutely. And what you can't do is put your head in the sand and believe it's going to go away. You need to find help. And there's a variety of different ways for you to find help, whether it's going to see a credit counselor to talk about your problems, especially before it gets too late, or see a good professional.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is Business Wise. Today our guest is Michael Debler. Michael is the lead person in charge of the Bankruptcy and Creditors Rights Group at Graydon Head Law Firm here in Cincinnati. And I know you're an expert on creditors and creditors' rights. Should people be particularly concerned this time of year? You know, we've seen that there's been a rise in retail sales, which is good for the retail businesses, but is it also good for creditors, for consumers who may be absorbing too much credit?
Yes, it is certainly a cautionary time when there's a lot of pressure out there to buy the newest electronic gear or the newest fashion item. People want to be generous at Christmas and provide things for the people they love. What they don't always think about is what happens in January when those credit card bills come in. Even though we have low interest rates, some of your credit cards have high interest rates, and they can become a real problem after the holidays are over. So people have to be careful that they prepare for what they may see in January.
Another point that I think so many people just don't realize is the ease in which college students can get college loans. We've been talking about bankruptcies. We've been talking about different types of ways to reduce debt. But unfortunately, for student loans, it's very difficult for a person to eliminate or reduce that type of debt.
That's absolutely correct. And with the job market the way it is today, we see a lot of students graduate from college and they have $50,000, $75,000 worth of student loans, and bankruptcy doesn't discharge those student loans unless there's a very severe hardship, and it's not going to be because you don't have a job. So they have to think about what the cost of the education is versus having to repay that, which could be a lifelong chore if they can't get rid of it in a bankruptcy someday.
Well, and really the time to think about that is when you're 18 or whatever age you are when you start college. Think about the fact that you're going to have to repay those loans someday and make sure that the income that you're going to receive as a result of that education is commensurate with that.
It's a benefit because the government makes it easy with the federal direct loans to obtain the student loans. The other side of that is that they come due at the end of the day, and you have to make sure you're going to have an income in order to pay those back.
Well, and we've seen from the mortgage crisis that the ability to get credit easily is not necessarily a good thing for a lot of people.
That's exactly right. While it makes you be able to pay for it today with a credit card, you have to realize on the other side of the coin, I've got to pay that money back no matter how low the interest rate is.
From a societal standpoint, it's just too easy. Money seems to be too easy, and maybe not as much as it today, but it's still pretty easy. What responsibility do business organizations have to monitor these types of things so people don't get so far in debt?
Even what we've seen with the recession, my 20-year-old daughter receives a flood of credit card solicitations in the mail from a variety of lenders out there. Some former TARP recipients who were in financial trouble still filter the mails with all of these solicitations.
So what's the solution? I mean, how do we really stop this ridiculousness in terms of excessive borrowing?
The local bankruptcy group of the Cincinnati Bar Association sponsors a program called CARE, which is a national program which is to teach students, whether they're high school or college, about the wise use of credit. We have a number of people that are affiliated with our group that go out to the high schools and talk to people about the wise use of credit, what credit can do for you and how it can harm you. So people have to learn when they're in high school, whether they think of an old home economics class, but they need to understand what checking accounts are, debit cards, credit cards, the wise use of credit, and it can't start too soon.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. Our guests today are Rick Maxwell. Rick is the president and CEO of Full Service Networking, and Chris Resch, which is Full Service Networking's chief technology officer. And Full Service Networking is an IT services company that you help clients here in our region with their IT services. And one thing that really is very annoying to me as I sit at my office and try to go through the hundreds of emails that we get is so many of them are just junk and spam. And it worries me that if I happen to click on it accidentally, I mean, am I really impairing, maybe infecting my computer at work?
Well, the best way to prevent damage to your systems is through user education. There is software and tools available that can help mitigate it, but really it's educating the end user on, you know, what to open, what not to. If you suspect something is bogus, there's a good chance that it is. You can contact the sender, you know, pick up the phone, send them an instant message, see if it was really from them. Or if you weren't expecting it, you know, why would they be sending you this picture out of the blue that references some obscure site?
It seems like we're seeing a lot, especially through the holidays, UPS. And if you've ordered something from UPS, it wouldn't be unreasonable to get an email about that. But many of those are not legitimate either, are they?
That's right. You see UPS, you see the IRS, you see it's time to renew your whatever. There's a lot of clever techniques to, again, get you to open that, and maybe even more importantly, get you to open the attachment.
We were talking about this in addition to just the identity theft issue. To the extent that these websites then can start capturing your keystrokes, how does that work?
So certain sites, if you open an attachment or visit a compromised website, they can put spyware on your computer. In effect, your computer becomes one of the ZombieNet PCs, and they can capture all the keystrokes. They can remotely control it, start sending spam from other accounts out of your PC, all sorts of bad stuff.
And certainly, I think many folks have some type of mobile device these days. Is it a good idea to conduct your personal affairs and your business affairs on a single device, or do you need two of those just to protect your business data?
We all commingle our business and personal uses on our personal device. Everyone's just now becoming aware of the potential threat. I can be out on a website for personal reasons, and again, unknowingly, perhaps visit the wrong website, and then go back to the office and conduct business using that same mobile device, sending business emails and business confidential information. And so it's a threat that's just really now coming to the forefront, and so are solutions. So,
and all the while, is what you're saying, if you did go to one of these bogus websites and they're capturing your keystrokes and you're putting client or business confidential information out there, the bad guys are getting that.
Could potentially be getting that, and there's a lot of bad guys out there right now.
And I think what you said, Chris, is very key, the whole idea of educating the workforce. And your company can actually go in as a part of its service solution, help employers educate their employees?
Absolutely. We can, yes.
And what's the website if people want more information about full service networking?
Fullservice.net. We very frequently have blog sessions that deal with this particular issue.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guests today are Rick Maxwell. Rick is the president and the CEO of Full Service Networking, which is an IT services company. And then Chris Resch, which is Full Service Networking's chief technology officer. I hear a lot about the cloud. The cloud, in my mind, is these white puffy things up in the sky, but it has a whole different meaning when it comes to technology.
I'll just start out by saying that I think there's a misconception that the cloud is somewhere off in the far, far distance, which it could be, but it also could be located, you know, right here in the greater Cincinnati marketplace. There's all sorts of flavors and configurations of what we call the cloud, but I think it's opened up a whole new avenue from a standpoint of sharing resources and better leveraging resources. And maybe I'll let Chris be a little more technically specific.
From the cloud standpoint, there's really lots of different clouds. You've got consumer-type clouds such as a Shutterfly or Facebook, where they're running in the cloud. It's a web app you access with your browser from almost any device, and your data stays there. You can access the application, and you don't need anything on your PC but a browser or your smartphone.
And I personally use Shutterfly. It's just a wonderful place to store pictures. I just pray that it's there and has an ongoing life there. But that is truly an example of using the cloud, correct?
Correct. And for consumer clouds, that is one of the big concerns. You know, we're signing up for all these free cloud-based services, but there is no guarantee that your pictures will be available in 10 years. They won't share them with somebody. You know, some of them have privacy policies, others don't. So you have to be very careful what you put up there and what you're willing to release.
But from a business standpoint, how does that work? Is it a cost savings, leveraging your costs? Is that how cloud helps companies?
So from a business standpoint, companies have a couple different cloud options as well. One is, you know, I can purchase my CRM application from a cloud provider. So I don't have to have any software in-house. Again, like a Salesforce.com, I use my browser to access it, and I've got my CRM application there.
Your customer relations management systems?
Correct. Or I can take it completely to my whole entire desktop can be a virtual desktop in the cloud. So when I log in via, again, my web browser or other device, I'm accessing what looks like a PC desktop, and any PC application can run on it, again, from whatever device I'm using.
So for companies who allow their employees to work from home remotely, that sounds like a great solution.
It is a great solution, not only for accessibility, but it gives the control over the antivirus and everything else. It keeps centralized control, but lets the consumer access it from any device.
Well, what are some of the downsides?
The downsides are, of course, you have to have internet connectivity to be able to use it. If you have no connectivity, you have no desktop to work on.
Is it expensive generally?
I think why it's gained such popularity is because it's becoming less and less expensive. And probably the biggest component of that is that we now have what they call virtual servers. So we can actually share physical server devices. And also the cost of the internet connection and the bandwidth, the speed of that transmission is coming down each and every day.
Your company, Full Service Networking, is a IT services and solutions company. You help businesses determine how to better utilize and leverage their IT resources, correct?
That's correct.
So can you all go in and help an organization determine if the cloud is the right thing for them or not?
We can, and actually we have several of our clients that operate in the cloud. But it's not right for every application, and it's not right for every environment. Someone might host their email in the cloud, but their line of business software they may want to keep on a local server. So yes, we can definitely do that.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your trusted business advocate.